This is 1A. I'm Jen White. The realities of sea level rise are ever present in coastal cities across the U.S., with sunny day flooding during high tide in Miami to the construction of seawalls around New York City. Sea level rise in island nations present an even more dire situation. Within the next 25 years, the Bahamas could see the sea level rise by a foot. A quarter of the population lives slightly more than a foot above sea level. To date, we explore what's being done to protect island communities from sea level rise and what responsibility the U.S. and other wealthy nations should have to support them. We also want to hear from you. Are you worried about losing coastlines to rising seas?
I live in Charlotte, North Carolina, but I grew up in Jamaica, and the beautiful beaches and coastline there are pivotal to my island's economy and culture. What concerns me most about rising sea levels is that developing island countries will not have the resources to mitigate the effects of rising sea levels, which stem from the careless industrialization of wealthy countries. Thanks.
William, thanks for that message. You can share your thoughts. Email us at 1A@WAMU.org or use our app, 1A Vox Pop. But let's start with Maxine Burkett. She's the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Oceans, Fisheries, and Polar Affairs at the State Department. We spoke earlier today. Maxine, I'd like to hear you respond to William's message. You're also from Jamaica and know the challenges facing Caribbean nations firsthand. How are Caribbean islands preparing for the inevitable rise of ocean waters and trying to build to adapt to it?
You're right. Coastal communities, island nations really are the literal front lines when it comes to the impacts of sea level rise on their communities, on their economies, on cultures in many cases as well. We are deeply concerned about that. And I think we have an opportunity here to really talk about the suite of responses that we can have to work with our partners within throughout the world and certainly in multilateral situations to be able to assist in transitioning from what we knew was the climate as we knew it and the one that we're facing ahead of us that includes these kinds of sea level rise impacts. I'd love to talk a bit about what we're doing with respect to supporting island nations to do that work. And in particular, you know, funding for adaptation is increasing on our watch, as is technical support for sea level rise that is going to be, again, the greatest impact on island nations and in particular their ability to be resilient in the face of it.
Talk a bit about the financial support side of things. How much is the United States providing to island nations?
Yeah, there's both sort of financial opportunities as well as in-kind opportunities for support. What we're seeing now, particularly under the President's Emergency Plan for Adaptation and Resilience, this is President Biden's plan to help more than 500 million people in developing countries adapt to and manage the impacts of climate change. And this is an important element of the work and opportunity for funding to, again, support with respect to resilience. And, of course, this is in addition to all of the other work that we're doing to reduce the risks and threats that are being faced by countries and communities. We also have the pledge by President Biden to the Adaptation Fund to double our contributions to $100 million, $150 million in new funding to accelerate adaptation and early warning systems across Africa for resilience, broader efforts for early warning systems to reduce impacts and save lives. There are multiple efforts that will address these vulnerabilities, again, when we're thinking about the increasing impacts result of sea level rise and other climate threats.
Later this hour, we hear from the climate envoy for the Republic of the Marshall Islands, Tina Yonanto Steggy. She's currently attending the United Nations climate talks in Germany, and she told us about the projections her country is facing.
The projections that we understand we're looking toward, and this is with a 1.5 degree increase in temperature, sort of the best case scenario. Between 2070 and 2090, we're looking at about 20 inches of sea level rise or 0.5 meters. Now in a country where you're just 2 meters above sea level or 6 feet, that amount of sea level rise makes many lands uninhabitable.
Speak to some of the specific challenges Pacific Islands are facing.
The Pacific Islands in particular are facing multitudes of impacts, again, that are occurring simultaneously. Sea level rise is critical, and many island nations, including the Marshall Islands, are not much above sea level and have to think very carefully about what their future looks like. There are a number of ways that we can address these issues, including reducing emissions and doing all of that important work with respect to mitigation so that we have better projections moving forward. But of course, there's also the funding for climate resilience, and particularly in the Pacific Islands, that we've been working on and working with them on. But there's also, as I've mentioned, ways to address the vulnerabilities that include things like recognizing new sea level rise norms. In other words, what we see happening is that as each inch of coastline is lost, a country's EEZs, their exclusive economic zones, where many resources and opportunities within 200 miles of their coastline lie, that those are threatened as each inch of coastline is lost. And so what we're looking at is how can we help Pacific Island nations, how can we support coastal communities around the world in being able to still access those. And so we are very committed to not only recognizing the existence of their baseline limits, the exclusive economic zones, and again, accessing all of those resources within those zones, but also providing the technical support so that there's opportunity to register their baselines, to technically hold on to them again for the opportunity to still have long-term access to those resources within their exclusive economic zones.
Maxine, I just want to talk about the reality of the costs associated with building resilient infrastructure for islands that are impacted by sea level rise. The cost of the Marshall Islands to reclaim and elevate the land is projected to cost tens of billions of dollars over the next century. That's according to a 2021 report from the World Bank. That country's GDP in 2021 was $259 million. How do island nations build resiliency to sea level rise given the astronomical costs?
We are committed to partnerships with the Pacific Islands to be able to get as much support as possible and get that support to be as a broad range in terms of the range of funding sources and contributors to those funding sources as available. This is a set of impacts that countries in many cases cannot face alone. And so it's going to be important that those partnerships are deepened and that there are other opportunities for us to reduce the threats and increase resilience in the face of them.
In March, the United Nations reached a landmark high seas treaty agreement after 20 years of negotiations, and this covers how the high seas should be governed and protected. Later this month, the UN will meet to officially adopt the exact language of the new high seas treaty. What's the significance of this treaty for ocean conservation?
Yeah, this is an incredibly exciting and important development as we think about the management of the ocean space. This is the high seas. This is the area of the planet that is two-thirds of the ocean itself that to date has been just high seas and has had not adequate protection given all of the rich, important ecosystem opportunities and services that it provides. What we saw happen in March was the conclusion of a landmark agreement. We had a text that came out of that years-long set of negotiations to have a framework for protecting the high seas. And that includes creating marine protected areas, which would be protected areas that would allow for thriving ecosystems. In particular, what we understand about the high seas again, is that there are opportunities for us to be able to address both the ocean crisis, impacts on biodiversity, impacts on fish stocks, as well as the climate crisis, because the ocean does a lot of work for us in managing our climate system, providing food, and providing other opportunities and life support systems for the planet and the people on it.
Now, the UN will meet again in September to try to formally ratify the High Seas Agreement, and they'll need at least 60 countries to formally sign it for the treaty to pass. What will be the challenges of enforcing the rules laid out in this agreement and holding countries accountable?
Yeah, well, with every agreement, we have the opportunity to have agreement and partnership so that we can actually have an effective mechanism, again, for the protection of the high seas, for creating marine protected areas. And there's an incredible amount of work that's done in the treaty. It's almost sort of four treaties in one to ensure that there are multiple organizations and bodies that are already working in that space, rowing together, if you will, with the purposes of the BB&J or the Biodiversity Beyond National Jurisdiction or High Seas Treaty purposes and goals, again, which is to create areas that would allow for increased biodiversity in ocean spaces. And those processes will allow for countries to work together to have the most ambitious approaches to protecting those areas. And that's going to be broad-based and will certainly include stakeholders who are, whether they're from the conservation community or the fisheries community, we have opportunities to work together to press for more ambitious action and coordination across countries.
Well, and briefly, studies show sea level rise will have devastating impacts on U.S. coastlines, too. What can U.S. cities learn about climate adaptation and resilience from island communities?
Great question. I think we have a lot of similarities with respect to how coastal communities and island nations relate and engage with their coastal environment. These, again, are places where not only economy, recreation, for example, will collide, but culture as well come together in these spaces. So we have coastal communities that have a lot at risk and, again, are similarly at the front lines. And what we see that's important is recognizing that the climate crisis is one that is going to impact their ability to fully engage in some respects, but there are opportunities for preparation that we're going to be key. And as we address those opportunities, whether it's looking at sustainable fisheries in the near coast area, or if it's looking at how to manage the economies that tend to be significantly within sort of that mile or so of the coastline, we can take from the island nations' clarion call for action opportunities for on-the-ground, community-based kinds of coordination to support long-term climate resilience.
That's Maxine Burkett. She's the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Oceans, Fisheries, and Polar Affairs at the State Department. Maxine, we appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
If you want to learn more about the High Seas Treaty, we spent an hour talking about it. You can find that conversation at the1a.org. Coming up, we travel from Greenland to Puerto Rico in a new book all about islands and rising seas. I'm Jen White. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. I'm Jen White. This is 1A. We're discussing the effect of sea level rise on islands across the globe. Christina Gerhardt has spent much of her career researching this issue. She's an associate professor at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. She's also an environmental journalist and the author of the new book, Sea Change, An Atlas of Islands in a Rising Ocean. Tina, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be on, Jen. Thanks for having me.
And joining us from Salinas, Puerto Rico is Ruth Santiago. She's an environmental attorney, activist, and a member of the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council. Ruth, it's great to have you back.
Hello. Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
And we're also hearing from you.
I live in South Louisiana, a state that's already seen so much coastal erosion that we have issues of flooding every hurricane because there's no longer the coastal boundaries that used to be there.
What concerns you most about rising seas in our coastlines? Email us at 1a@wamu.org or reach us via our app, 1A Vox Pop. Atina, your book, Sea Change, examines the threat of sea level rise to dozens of island nations, republics, and commonwealths across the globe. And they represent a diverse range of geographies, population sizes, economies, and cultures. What are some of the challenges these island communities have in common as ocean levels continue to rise?
Right. So thanks for the question. Sea Change, my book, I refer to it as a symphony, by which I mean that it weaves together maps, art, essays, and poems by islanders to really create a polyvocal or polyphonic discussion of the impacts of sea level rise. I think one of the things that pulls together islands that are featured in Sea Change, and this is picking up the thread from Maxine Burkett, is the issue of economic disparity. So economic disparity exists between nations, and most of the islands in Sea Change have very low GDPs. They have threshold economies, whether you measure that by GDPs or individual incomes. There's exceptions like the Maldives and Singapore, which are incidentally not incidentally, building islands and expanding, but most islands in sea change have low GDPs, which means they cannot afford some of the adaptation efforts that Maxine Burkett mentioned at the top. So on the one hand, the global north is disproportionately responsible for the missions, but then on the other hand, you add to this that these inequities stem from colonialism, by which I mean inequities baked into financial systems. And I think important work being done there that I would want to flag for your listeners is Mia Mottley, Prime Minister of Barbados. She's been doing incredible work to unpick and revamp financial systems such as the World Bank, the IMF, that have been in place since the 1944 Bretton Woods meeting.
Ruth, Puerto Rico has experienced severe weather events causing disaster declarations every year since 2001. The devastating effects of Hurricanes Maria, Irma, and Fiona on infrastructure, that'll be felt for years to come. How vulnerable is Puerto Rico to rising seas and extreme weather events?
Yeah, well, the experience has shown that you decided that we are very vulnerable. So, for example, after Hurricane Maria, there was a total power outage in the archipelago, the main island and the two, especially two island municipalities, which went on for months and in some places even close to a year without power. And so extreme vulnerability that also affected water supply, drinking water supplies, and sanitation water. And so, yeah, people died. There were from 3,000 to 5,000 deaths, estimated deaths, excess deaths related to all of that situation. Mm-hmm. So, we are in Hurricane Alley.
Yeah.
And the waters around Puerto Rico are extremely heated, 2 degrees above what the historic temperature was in the waters around us. And that's a perfect mix for hurricanes and more intense storms and rain events.
Well, according to NOAA, 66% of Puerto Rico's population lives in coastal areas. Help us understand how sea level rise is felt and experienced in daily life.
Okay, well, in a few ways. One is that, for example, all of the big power plants, they're all fossil-fired, unfortunately, they are all in coastal areas. For example, here in Salinas, 10 minutes down the road, is the Aguirre Power Complex, and it's right on the coast. So, for example, when there's turbulence or when there are events of sargasso blooms, the intake structures for the plant that allow for the cooling water to come in for the boilers have gotten stopped up. So just the whole operation of the big power plants is impacted by events at sea. They are at risk of being flooded. Not just by sea level rise, but also by storm surge. And then on the other hand, in terms of water supply, for example, a municipality like Salinas and quite a few others, quite a few other communities throughout southern Puerto Rico depend on what is known as the South Coast Aquifer. It's groundwater that discharges into the sea, and we're now seeing what is known as saltwater intrusion. That is, instead of the flows of fresh water into the sea, now the seawater is flowing into the aquifer, and that makes it that damages the drinking water use for that important source of water.
I just want to mention that sargassum bloom, that's a free-floating mackerel algae that can suddenly bloom in the ocean and cause some of the issues you described earlier. Yet, Tina, your book starts with your visit to Greenland. The melting of its land ice could contribute to a foot in sea level rise by 2100. And you spoke with University of Miami professor Harold Wanless, who paints a really devastating picture. He says, quote, Greenland is currently calving chunks of ice so large they produce earthquakes up to 6 or 7 on the Richter scale. And this is something you witnessed firsthand. Describe it for us.
Yeah, right. So the impact, I start with Greenland for a couple of reasons. The melt of the ice on Greenland, at the poles on Greenland and the Arctic, and on the Thwaites Glacier and Pine Island in the Antarctic, those are the sources of our sea level rise. That's one of the reasons. The other reason is because when oceans heat up, the water expands. So all of the increase in temperature that Maxime Burkett and Ruth Santiago have been describing should be read as sea level rise. To come back to your question, Jen, when we arrived on Greenland via boat, before we saw this kind of melt, we actually heard it. So there's these gentle popping sounds that you hear initially. It's kind of like ice cubes being dropped in a glass of warmer liquid. You hear this crackling as the air bubbles escape or melt. And then there's a crescendo. There's groaning sounds. It's like you're listening to a whale. But what you're listening to when you hear this rumble, this roar, is millions of tons of ice of glaciers calving off and thunderously crashing into the sea. And so the sounds of the melt are really intense when you're actually there. And there's rivers flowing, there's water flowing as these glaciers melt and gush into the sea.
And just explain in more detail how that's driving global sea level rise.
Right. So when you have this melt that's taking place at the poles, this is the source of sea level rise, and it impacts island nations that are around the world. So I know you're going to have climate envoy Tina Stege from the Republic of Marshall Islands on later in the show. And I open this chapter not only with Greenland, but at the very end, I have a poem that has poet Aka Niviana from Greenland in conversation with Kathy Jetnell Kiesner, who's also a climate envoy and also from the Republic of Marshall Islands. I have them in conversation in this poem, Rise. And the reason I start the book, Sea Change, with this poem is to indicate that the melt on Greenland influences the Republic of Marshall Islands. The Republic of Marshall Islands is an archipelagic, low-lying island nation in the Pacific. And what that means is that they are on average 6 to 6.5 feet above sea level. And what the predictions are for sea level rise by 2050 by the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that's their scientific body, is by 2050 to have 1 foot of sea level rise, and by the end of the century, 3 feet of sea level rise. Now, that's a super conservative estimate of sea level rise. There are scientists who predict we might have 8 to 10 feet by the end of the century. So if you have an island nation that's low-lying, that's 6.5 feet above sea level rise, it's either, unfortunately, possibly going to be underwater, and even if it isn't, the inundation that it experiences makes life really uninhabitable on these island nations. The most at risk globally are the Republic of Marshall Islands, Kiribati and Tuvalu in the Pacific, and the Maldives in the Indian Ocean.
We're talking to Tina Gerhardt. She's an associate professor at the University of Hawaii and author of Sea Change. Also with us is Ruth Santiago. She's an environmental attorney and a member of the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Board. We're also hearing from you. Dave from Arkansas sent us this message with our app 1A Vox Pop. Sea level rise isn't just something that affects other places on the globe. My hometown of Imperial Beach, California, now faces what are called king tides that flood portions of the town. How concerned are you about our disappearing coasts amid rising seas? If you live on a coastline or have connections to island nations, what changes do you see? Email us at 1A at WAMU.org or use our app 1A Vox Pop. Ruth, according to the latest Census Bureau statistics, 40% of Puerto Rico's population is in poverty. That's nearly double the poverty rate of Mississippi, the state with the highest poverty in the country. How is climate change and sea level rise contributing to economic insecurity in Puerto Rico?
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, we have a very high poverty rate. The median income here is about one-third that of the U.S., about $21,000, and yet we also experience one of the highest, sometimes even the highest electric rate of any U.S. jurisdiction. Right now, we're close to 30 cents per kilowatt hour. So That creates a situation of lack of access to energy, basically energy injustice. And at the same time, we're seeing that people who are better off, for example, are acquiring rooftop solar equipment. And so in a sense, it's as if we were developing two separate and very unequal electric systems. The poor largely need to depend on the centralized, largely fossil-fired grid, whereas people, higher-income people, have access to distributed renewable energy through rooftop solar coupled with battery energy storage systems. So that can make the difference between life and death, right? And it has already. We saw even last fall, beyond just Hurricane Maria, but in last fall with Hurricane Fiona, which was only a Category 1 hurricane, that there, again, excess deaths right at that period from September through December of 2022 that are related to the power outages that were brought about because of Hurricane Fiona and because of this new company that's operating the grid that doesn't have the workforce or the know-how on how to manage this very complex system that we have in the archipelago.
Well, President Biden visited Puerto Rico after Hurricane Fiona last fall and pledged immediate storm aid. FEMA has granted more than $640 million in disaster aid for families since that storm hit last September. As I said, you sit on the White House Advisory Council. How much has the Biden administration turned its focus to Puerto Rico and the climate challenges it's facing?
Okay, so one important initiative of the Biden administration is known as the PR100, and it's run by the Department of Energy with six national labs, and they're looking for pathways to achieve Puerto Rico's renewable portfolio standard or renewable energy goal, right, which is in place, and it's very ambitious. But unfortunately, we're not en route to achieving it, and this happened with a previous goal as well. And so I guess that's why the Biden administration is coming in and trying to facilitate the process. They, for example, issued a report this past January saying that Puerto Rico has 4 to 6 times the rooftop solar potential compared to all of its energy demand. And as an island with very limited geographic space and a place that's been described as a mountain range surrounded by a narrow coastal plain, siting solar arrays on land is difficult. It's not recommended in any of the studies that I've seen. And so DOE pretty much confirmed what it had said before and what the faculty at the University of Puerto Rico said about more than 10 years ago, and other studies with NGOs here have concluded that we really should transform the system towards distributed renewable energy, like especially rooftop solar, microgrids that are based on localized solar and coupled with other programs that are alternatives to this centralized fossil-fired system.
We are hearing from our listeners, and Caitlin in South Carolina sent this. I work with a nonprofit here called the Outside Foundation, and we have been combating rising ocean levels and becoming more storm resilient by recycling oysters. Over the past 2 years, we've recycled over 82 tons of oyster shells. We take that and we bag it and we create new reefs. Tina, how often are we seeing these more innovative approaches to trying to combat sea level rise?
Right. So some of the approaches to dealing with sea level rise that I talk about in Sea Change are two broad categories. Hard engineering on the one hand, and that includes things like building seawalls or even raising entire island nations because of how low they are, the atolls that I was mentioning previously. The other larger and broader category that I spend more time on in Sea Change is to talk about soft engineering or nature-based solutions. So that would include restoring or protecting coral and oyster reefs, as well as restoring and protecting mangrove forests, and then also protecting wetlands. So coral reefs are often referred to as the lungs of the ocean, and it's estimated because they do what rainforests do on land. They absorb a lot of CO2 emissions, but it's estimated about 85% of coral reefs, and there's the figures are similar for oyster reefs, have been destroyed around the world.
Mm. Well, let's pause here briefly. We're talking about sea level rise and its effect on our islands. We're here with Tina Gerhardt, an associate professor at the University of Hawaii and author of the new book Sea Change, and Ruth Santiago, an environmental attorney and advocate. Coming up.
For so many decades, there was no acknowledgement that there were losses and damages and that these needed to be addressed. And so we need the wealthier countries to come along with us.
More just ahead. Now let's get back to our discussion about the effect of sea level rise on island communities. Tina Gerhardt is with us. She's an associate professor at the University of Hawaii and the author of the new book, Sea Change. Also with us is Ruth Santiago. She's an environmental attorney and a member of the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council. Let's turn now to the Marshall Islands. The United States Geological Survey projects that some of the islands will be completely submerged by 2035 due to rising seas. Tina Yonamto Stegi is a climate envoy for the Republic of the Marshall Islands. She's currently in Bonn, Germany at the UN Climate Talks. She spoke with 1A producer Chris Remington from the conference. It continues until June 15th.
I was hoping you could paint a picture for our listeners who haven't been to the Marshall Islands and might not be familiar with the landscape. It was remarkable for me to read that some of these islands are only a few dozen yards across. What does the experience of sea level rise look like on a daily basis now, and how you're sort of thinking about adaptation in the future?
If you come to the Marshall Islands, and hopefully you will, when you fly into the Marshall Islands, as you land, if you look out your window, you pretty much only see blue. The runway is on a strip of the island that is so narrow that it essentially the strip comprises the runway. And most of the rest of the island isn't much larger than that. We're on average about 6 feet above sea level. So what does adaptation mean for us? Adaptation to sea level rise will necessarily mean protecting what land we have now, but also eventually having to raise it.
You're joining us from the United Nations Climate Talks in Bonn, Germany, as the climate envoy for the Marshall Islands. What's the primary focus for you for these ongoing climate negotiations?
We're really here to make sure that we deliver on promises already made, promises made in Paris to keep temperature rise to 1.5 degrees, to ensure the safety of countries like the Marshall Islands, but also the safety of the planet as a whole. But we're also here to push for more ambition for countries to do more to help countries like the Marshall Islands respond to the impacts of climate change. So, you know, our needs to adapt, our needs now to respond to the loss and damage that we're seeing.
And can you give me a sense of what that means on a practical level in terms of holding countries accountable to that goal agreed in Paris?
On the mitigation side, it comprises several different things. Promises have been made even more recently in Glasgow to, for example, end fossil fuel subsidies and massively scaling up renewables, which the technologies there, the pathways are there. These are things and actions that can be done. We just need the political will to see them delivered. And that political will has to be backed up by finance, which has really been lacking up to this point. So there are lots of ambitious plans out there, but you need the policy and you need the money.
Yeah, let's talk about those finances, because one of the key takeaways from the COP27 summit held in Egypt this past fall focused on the notion of climate reparations, having wealthier countries support vulnerable countries to the impacts of climate change. The United Nations established a fund to begin that process. How should that fund be used to support climate resilience measures in your countries and other Pacific Island countries?
A loss and damage fund was agreed. How it will work is something that is an ongoing discussion here in Bonn at these intersessional meetings. And that discussion will take place, continue to take place over the course of the year until finally what we'll need to see at COP28 is that fund operationalized. We're also talking about something that maybe doesn't sound sexy, but what we call non-economic loss, those things like cultural heritage. If we're forced to leave a particular piece of land or a particular atoll, that means that you also leave a lot of the stories behind, the stories that are connected to land. And those are losses that also need to be considered, even if there isn't a particular value associated. It's almost an incalculable value. So those are the discussions that are ongoing here, and they're very difficult.
You spoke earlier about the threat of losing an atoll and what that would mean for the Marshall Islands culturally. And I want to talk about this notion of managed retreat. It's being discussed increasingly in the United States, migrating communities in areas vulnerable to sea level rise to higher ground. In the country of Kiribati, the former president, Anote Tong, purchased land in neighboring Fiji for residents to move to in the event of climate disaster. Is managed retreat a topic that's being discussed in the Marshall Islands, and is it even an option?
We're looking at all the options, but one thing is clear from our leaders, our traditional leaders, our chiefs, all of our elected leaders in the last many decades, to the youngest of us who have spoken out on issues around climate change, and middle schoolers and high schoolers. All of those Marshallese, when they're asked about questions around moving or migrating or leaving, will tell you that it's not a viable option. How much we would be losing. Leaving your homeland means you're leaving yourself. You're leaving what makes you you. What makes your identity and all of those things that, you know, make us unique as a people and as a culture. We have to look at what the science says and what we'll need to do. And we're looking at transformational adaptation, seeing what can be done to stay in place. Transformational adaptation is so key to essentially our own self-determination. But I think it's important to note, as we were talking about loss and damage earlier, that in adapting, we already know that that means loss. There will be loss and damage involved in the adaptation that we need to do.
I want to end with a poem that speaks to that idea of identity from Kathy Jetneel Kitchener. She's also a climate envoy with the Marshall Islands, and she's a poet and climate activist. She opened the 2014 United Nations Climate Talks. Here she is delivering a poem for her daughter.
Dear Mata Felipinum, I want to tell you about that lagoon, that lazy lounging lagoon, lounging against the sunrise. Men say that one day that lagoon will devour you. They say it will gnaw at the shoreline, chew at the roots of your breadfruit trees, gulp down rows of seawalls, and crunch through your island's shattered bones. They
say I work as climate envoy for the Marshall Islands, and my partner in that effort is actually Kathy. Experience as Marshallese people, the day-to-day life that we have, the things that make us unique as a culture and as a people, all of those lived experience is what we bring to, you know, these climate negotiations. And we try to share to help people understand why this effort to respond to the climate crisis, to keep the temperature increased to 1.5, to ensure that we have a safe and secure future for ourselves, for our children, for our grandchildren. These are all grounded in all the wonderful, joyful experiences that are recounted and expressed in Kathy's poetry.
Dear Mata Felipinum, you are eyes heavy with drowsy weight. So just close those eyes and sleep in peace, because we won't let you down. You'll see.
That was producer Chris Remington speaking with Tina Steggy. She's a climate envoy for the Republic of the Marshall Islands. And the poem you heard was from Kathy Jetneel Kitchener. Still with us are Tina Gerhardt, associate professor at the University of Hawaii and author of the new book, Sea Change, An Atlas of Islands in a Rising Ocean, and Ruth Santiago, environmental attorney and advocate in Puerto Rico. Ruth, we heard from Tina there reflections not just on improving infrastructure and making the Marshall Islands more resilient, but also a fear that rising seas lead to a loss of culture, a loss of identity. What resonates for you about the experience in the Marshall Islands from your perch in Puerto Rico?
Yeah. So Salinas, where I'm based, where I live, where I'm from, is a coastal municipality. We have 44 of the 78 municipalities here that are coastal. Salinas in particular was a place of small fishing villages dotting the coast. And that increasingly has gone away. Fishers, for example, and I remember over the years hearing about fishers having to go further and further out and sometimes getting lost and ending up in South America. And that culture around artisanal fishing is certainly being impacted by the climate crisis and all of its implications. And I think now, after this experience with the big hurricanes in the 2017 season, that there's a generalized sense of trauma here about having another hurricane come through and losing especially electric service and sometimes water and, just things, telecommunications, which were out in some places even longer than the power supply after Hurricane Maria. So all of that, of course, affects culture, affects quality of life, communities. But I think it's important to emphasize here in this discussion that Puerto Rico, other places like this, and coastal areas in general need not be places of unmitigated disaster. There are things that we can do. And as I mentioned, one of them is to transform electric systems away from the big centralized power plants and that are so dependent on usually coastal resources, especially water and or rivers, and move away from that paradigm towards decentralization, not just decarbonization, but decentralization, and in a sense, empower communities through decentralized systems like I mentioned, rooftop solar and storage, but empower communities to participate as what professors here call prosumers, producers, not just passive consumers of energy.
I want to get to this question we got from Kit, who says, won't a lot of island nations need to be depopulated? And this is something Tina Steggy talked about, the idea of managed retreat, and how her country's residents are grappling with that possibility. Tina, why has managed retreat become such a controversial topic in the scientific community?
Right. Yeah. Thanks for that question. The issue of managed retreat is vexed. I mean, you mentioned former head of state of Kiribati, Anote Tong, purchasing land on a neighboring island, and that's Fiji. And that island nation in itself is experiencing the impacts of sea level rise. So that's one issue. We also talk about managed retreat in continental areas. I'm phoning in from California, so we talk about it here. And one of the issues of managed retreat is obviously the issue of gentrification due to the climate crisis, right? By which I mean specifically that people are moving from one area to another to avoid the impacts of climate change. Another issue is the financial structure of managed retreat. So sometimes you have, and I know this example from Hawaii where I teach, you have taxpayer money that's being used to buy out wealthy homeowners who live in coastal regions. So that's another issue to consider. I was writing in Sea Change about an example on the Solomon Islands where an entire village was moved away from a coastline inland, and sociologists were involved, environmentalists were involved, and they were tracking how cohesive that move was for protecting the community. But there are the kinds of losses that both Tina Stege and Ruth Santiago have mentioned, and also Kathy Jetnell-Kishner in her writing, that have to do with the cultural losses and being deeply rooted and connected and tied to a place. So even if one moves an entire village out of harm's way and does so cohesively, that's a considerable loss to also consider.
Well, there's also the cost associated with a move like that. We got this question from Kurt who says, we can't stop it, but shouldn't we make polluters pay for all the things communities are going to have to pay for to deal with the damage? Tina, we've just got a few seconds left here, but what's the status of the financial piece of this, especially for poor countries, island nations that don't have the financial wherewithal to pay for what's needed?
Right. I think that's where we can come full circle for the program and look large at the UN climate negotiations going on this week. Tina Stege is very responsible for getting the loss and damage facility, which has been discussed for 30 years, to the point that it got to last year at the UN climate negotiations, which is with much heel dragging on the part of the US and the EU, it did cross the finish line. That means that there was a decision to implement it, and they are now working out or hammering out the details of its structure. But the other thing that's being negotiated on the international level is what I mentioned previously, which is Mia Motley's proposal to really radically revamp financial structures at the World Bank, the IMF.
Well, we will continue to watch that story. That's Tina Gerhardt. She's an associate professor at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Her new book is called Sea Change, an Atlas of Islands in a Rising Ocean. Also with us, Ruth Santiago. She's an environmental attorney and activist based in Puerto Rico. She's also a member of the White House Environmental Justice Task Force. Thanks to you both. The 1A Text Club is a great way to share your questions and ideas with us. You'll only ever get one text a day. You can sign up under the Talk to 1A tab at the1a.org. Today's producers were Chris Remington and Maya Garg. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening. We'll talk more soon. This is 1A.